Welcome back. It's a Thursday, the third day of January 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and there's a whole lot of news today from economics to earthquakes, but I can't help thinking the most important and certainly telling bit of news is actually coming out of Washington, D.C. No, not the alleged shutdown, and certainly the sewage level in the swamp is anything but draining, but this. At 12 o'clock noon Eastern Standard Time, the 116th Congress took the oath of office. Now, just in case you've forgotten, and I guarantee you it doesn't seem to matter anymore, it reads something like this. Actually, it reads exactly like this. I, fill in the name of the communist here, do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I'm about to enter, so help me God. Unquote. And no, that's not the same as Allah, but we'll come back to that. And let me remind you folks, we have almost an entire California delegation and a whole bunch of others who have already indicated in no uncertain terms that they have no intent whatsoever of honoring that oath, and arguably not any part of it, whether we're talking about the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, or any of the rest of it. Traitor Eric Swalwell, and I use those terms explicitly, has already announced his intention to make war upon not only the Constitution, but the citizens of these United States. And if you don't like it, as he so quaintly put it, the traitors now have nukes. The new, sadly, Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, third in line for the throne, has a list of things as long as your arms, every one of which is unconstitutional, that she intends to implement, and that oath be damned. And then there's the likes of people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's pretty much too stupid to even understand what the oath was all about to begin with, much less the concept of the Constitution and rule of law. So I'm going to ask a really serious question at this point, and I'll try to be as polite as I can, given the context. What the hell is the purpose of the oath nowadays anyway? Why does anybody in the District of Criminal Swamp even bother with the pretense? From gun confiscation to ending free speech to, of course, impeachment, because we really, really don't like that guy who actually won the election, I'll contend, folks, that it's no longer even possible for the most self-deluded to convince themselves that any of these, no, they're not idiots, folks, they're evil, with a couple of glaring exceptions who are clearly both, who put their hand on a Bible and just lied through their teeth, have any intention whatsoever of paying even lip service anymore to the Constitution and rule of law. I alluded to this story, and I guess we ought to get around to it, disgusting as it might be. Christina Lela's coverage of the Gateway Pundit correctly calls this a disgusting mockery, noting that incoming Muslim Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib was sworn into office sick on Thursday using a centuries-old Quran, once belonging to a far better man, signer of the Declaration of Independence and one of America's greatest presidents, Thomas Jefferson. Now, here's the part of this entire story that gets consistently overlooked. As Barry Sabarco once put it, yes, Thomas Jefferson did have a copy of the Quran for the same reason that people who hate Nazism might have a copy of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. And some of us who really do like free markets have still read Marx and Engels. The concept is called Know Your Enemy, which is explicitly confirmed by the inscription in front of Jefferson's Quran by George Sale, which pretty much says exactly that, basically reminding us that it's important to understand what that book actually says so as to, quote, enable us to effectually expose the imposture, unquote. The anti-constitutional so-called congresswoman, who knows full well that Sharia so-called law is utterly incompatible, not only the First Amendment, but the concept of God-given rights in its entirety, actually said something which, if you read it in the proper Clintonian style, really does have the ring of truth. The Democrat Socialist told the Detroit Free Press, quote, "It's important to me because a lot of Americans have this kind of feeling that Islam is somehow foreign to American history." And that's true, as far as it goes, because it turns out they were just on the other side. The Shores of Tripoli from the Marines' Hymn and the war with the Barbary Pirates are all a fact of American history. It's a war that John Adams knew then and warned would continue. Listen to the rest of this quote from the latest Congress traitor. Muslims, she said, were there at the beginning. Some of our founding fathers knew more about Islam than some members of Congress now. And that's absolutely, without question, true. And that goes for most Americans as well. The reason Jefferson had a Koran was because it gave him an insight into what were then called the Mohammedans and what they justified in the name of their prophet and their God, all of which disturbed the third president quite deeply because he believed in religious tolerance and realized, the more he studied Islam, that it was the exact opposite. The man who co-authored the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom realized that Islam was quite unlike any other religion that most Jews or Christians of the time had ever been exposed to because it was based on supremacism, and its holy books not only condoned but mandated violence against unbelievers, and all of that was unacceptable to Thomas Jefferson, who, along with Adams, indicated that their greatest fear was that someday Islam would pose an even greater threat to the United States than it did during their time. And we're there. And let me summarize some of this problem in a single sentence. Unlike other so-called members of Congress who put their hand on a Bible and lied before a God they probably don't believe in, this Michigan Congress traitor put her hand on a Koran and took an oath that she at least knew she had no intention whatsoever of honoring. And here's the Clintonian irony in all of that. Thomas Jefferson had that Koran because he knew the incredible danger that this false religion represented to the First Amendment and the entire rule of law upon which the Declaration and Constitution were based. So here you go. This woman lied with her hand on a so-called holy book that says, when you lie to serve the ends of Islam, like she just did, that's perfectly okay. They've even got a name for it, actually more than one, Taqiya or Kitman. And yeah, folks, back when we once had a rule of law, all of this was called treason, because it's about making war, call it jihad if you like, against the American republics. And there are no shortage of examples as to what that means. More gun confiscation bills have already been filed, and yet more resolutions for impeachment against the guy they hate almost as much as the Bill of Rights and the American people, the real ones, are already in the works too. Are you ready for this? One of them, because Trump dared to fire one of the biggest scumbags in the entire district of criminals, the Whoremeister himself, James Comey. Meanwhile, the incredible, and I mean literally almost unbelievable level of criminality of the Mueller gang and of Comey's cover-up and obstruction of justice and literally suborning perjury, committing perjury, and, well, good grief. A half-hour show is hardly long enough to list the crimes these people have committed. And it's not even getting noticed by the new gang of oathbreakers. No wonder they're so hot to trot to make pointing out real criminality and treason an impeachable offense. Here's a long article that just the headline is all we have time for today. Stunning, says Joe Hoft at the Gateway Pundit. The Mueller gang has been caught, again, stealing protected evidence. And when, oh when, will U.S. so-called judges see this witch hunt for what it is? Corrupt, criminal, and a continuing coup in progress. Well, as of today, folks, the circus is back in town, and truth isn't going to be anywhere close to the swamp. On to the economic meltdown, also still in progress, and yeah, I'm sure the new Congress sick will want to impeach Trump for this too, even though he's not the CEO of Apple. But that is, at least, the big story on Wall Street today. Apple, said the Wall Street Journal, makes a rare cut to sales guidance, and the CEO, Tim Cook, has cited slowing sales in China in a letter to investors that literally has those so-called investors panicking because on Thursday morning, Apple slashed its quarterly revenue forecast for the first time in more than a decade and a half, an unprecedented move for the CEO Tim Cook era that was prompted by a major downturn of iPhone sales in China. Too bad Apple doesn't follow Henry Ford's example. Remember, folks, Ford, back in the early 1900s, actually wanted his workers to be able to afford to buy the company's product, the Model T. Apple seems more concerned about making sure its slave labor doesn't jump out of buildings to kill themselves. Maybe it's not surprising they don't want to buy an iPhone. And the surprising cut in a letter from the CEO to investors renewed concerns about waning demand for Apple's marquee product, the iPhone, which makes up the vast share of its revenue. Well, folks, Apple employees may be facing suicide nets in China, but perhaps the same isn't true for investors on Wall Street, because they really took it hard. Shares took an immediate tumble. At one point, they were down 9% to mid-2017 lows, and the once-trillion-dollar company, after being halted temporarily, saw its plunging share price wipe out more than $50 billion of the company's market value. And the carnage rapidly spread not only to other big tech, but other markets as well. A Zero Hedge story before the markets opened called it chained liquidation, stemming from the after-hour share collapse of AAPL, and noted that multiple foreign exchange pairs too were suddenly crashing as yields tumbled, and even paper gold on the crooked casinos surged in response. A mid-morning story from Barron's put it this way: Dow drops 519 points because the market has even bigger problems than just Apple. Like a drop in the ISM's manufacturing index. Oh, and let's not forget the Fed. So, folks, as I do this recording, a couple hours before the markets close, gold is up about $7, silver up even more percentage-wise, 17 cents, just over 1.1%, at about $15.70 for an ounce you still really can't buy at that price, while the Dow, as I mentioned, is down over 500 points, S&P down 41, and the NASDAQ down almost 150. I guess after all of that, it's time for a bit of comic relief. Here's one from Howard Kurtz via Fox News, a former editor of the New York Times, of all places, in a new and soon-to-be-released book, has now ripped her former paper's coverage concerning the president that they all love to hate as biased. Jill Abramson, the veteran journalist and former executive editor of the New York Times, back when the paper had actual pages dedicated to news, between 2011 and 2014, said the Times has a financial incentive to bash the president and that the imbalance is helping, as if they needed it, to erode its already kind of minimal credibility. She said the paper has become, quote, unmistakably anti-Trump. And in the soon-to-be-published book, Merchants of Truth, Abramson defended the Times in a few ways, but offered some harsh words for her successor, Dean Baquet, saying, quote, though Baquet said publicly he didn't want the Times to be the opposition party, his news pages were unmistakably anti-Trump, she wrote, adding she believes the same is true of the WAPO, noting that some headlines contained raw opinion, as did some of the stories that were labeled as news analysis. What's more, she says, citing legendary 20th century publisher Adolph Oakes, quote, the more anti-Trump the Times was perceived to be, the more it was mistrusted for being biased. Oakes' vow to cover the news without fear or favor sounded like an impossible promise in such a polarized environment, unquote. Oh, she also explained the Times' bias by noting that, quote, given its mostly liberal audience, there was an implicit financial reward for the Times in running lots of Trump stories, almost all of them negative. They drove big traffic numbers, and despite the blip of cancellations after the election, inflated subscription orders to levels no one had previously anticipated. And notes Kurtz, although the Times has long faced accusations of kind of unmistakable liberal bias, even before Trump got into politics and became its harshest critic, Abramson's words carry special weight because she is also a former Times Washington bureau chief and Wall Street Journal correspondent specializing in investigative reporting. This next story kind of helps to buttress that point. Via John Solomon from The Hill, as well as Zero Hedges and The Gateway Pundit Summaries, as the latter put it, The Hill reported that the intelligence community, SIC, remained silent when General Michael Flynn was accused of working with Russia, but what he didn't mention was that it was suspected that a deep state spy set him up. Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge remind us that we've learned a lot more over the last month about the circumstances surrounding the departure of the former National Security Advisor of the new Trump administration, Michael Flynn, who pled guilty to making false statements, probably under some pressure, as we've seen since, to the FBI about a conversation with then-Ambassador to the United States, Sergei Kislyak,
one on December the 29th of 2016, in which Flynn urged the Russians, and probably correctly, to, quote, refrain from escalating the situation in response to sanctions that the U.S. had imposed against Russia, and another conversation in which Kislyak told Flynn that Russia had decided to moderate its response following the request. Nothing, of course, either earth-shattering, illegal, or collusive, not in the witch hunt sense, but Flynn, we were told later, was not forthcoming with the Department of Justice or the VP, Mike Pence. He was later fired and then pled guilty in December 2017 to making, oh, and this is the only real treason left in the United States, folks, false statements to the federal bunglers of investigation. And he's been painted as a Russian stooge ever since, notes the paper, with critics pointing to a famous picture via Russia Today where he sat next to Russian President Vladimir Putin. They don't nearly so much like to mention that U.S. Green Party candidate at the time, Jill Stein, was also in attendance. And more importantly, the Obama regime knew everything about that dinner, and Flynn briefed U.S. intelligence officials on the trip, according to John Solomon, whose sources told him the contents of a classified briefing to Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley in May 2017 that Grassley has urged be released to the public had a whole lot more interesting information in it. In a letter he wrote in August to James Mattis and DIA Director General Vincent Stewart, the senator said it appears the public release of this information would not pose any ongoing risk to national security. No, not like leaking all the stuff that Hitler did, for sure. And basically, the rest of the story goes on to say, had the Grassley-requested memo been made public, America would have learned a whole lot more about the situation, and that if anything, rather than being a diplomatic embarrassment bordering on treason, Flynn's conduct at the RT event probably provided some modest benefit to the U.S. intelligence community, something that many former military and intelligence officers continue to offer their country after retirement when they get to keep security clearances. Isn't that amazing? Solomon did say there's, of course, no sugarcoating the mistakes that Flynn did make. But having said all of that, the narrative that Flynn was somehow a Russian stooge, as evidenced by that RT dinner, is now dead. And furthermore, Flynn was never charged with anything even remotely related to that event, and he did come back to the United States and report to the intelligence community things that would ultimately benefit his country. He was, after all, prepping for a job, folks. And as Solomon puts it, the first accounts of the Russia Flynn story, like many others in the still unproven and by this point largely discredited collusion narrative, should now be amended to reflect the fact that the retired general acted like a patriot, not a traitor, when he visited Moscow for the RT event. I guess the moral of the story for today is, if you really want to be a traitor, the place to do it is Congress. You better put your hand on something anyway and lie your you-know-what off before the American people. Which leads me finally to this story that's really kind of interesting and certainly portends more to come. Comes via Zero Hedge as well, and it's about a hacking collective known as the Dark Overlord, which announced on New Year's Eve that it had broken into the computer systems of a law firm and obtained a whole lot of files related to the infamous September 9/11 attacks so many years ago and so covered up, and they've threatened to publicly release a large cache of internal files unless a hefty ransom is paid, according to Motherboard. Says the demand, Hiscox Syndicates Limited and Lloyd's of London are some of the biggest insurers on the planet, insuring everything from the smallest policies to some of the largest policies on the planet, and who even insured structures such as the World Trade Centers, said the group's announcement. And according to the spokesperson for the Hiscox Group, the hackers breached the law firm, which advised the company, and had likely stolen files linked to litigation tied to the 9/11 attacks and false flag. Quote, this law firm's systems are not connected to Hiscox IT infrastructure, and Hiscox's own systems were unaffected by this incident. One of the cases the law firm handled for Hiscox and other insurers related to litigation arising from the events of 9/11, and we believe that information relating to this was stolen during that breach, said the spokesperson to Motherboard in an email. Now here's the really interesting and juicy stuff. The hacking group published a small set of letters, emails, and other documents that mentioned various law firms, as well as the Transportation Sexual Abusers, TSA, and the FAA. TSA couldn't provide a statement in time for publication, says the story, and the FAA told Motherboard they're investigating. And although the released documents so far seem somewhat innocuous, the group says it may release more. And in the extortion note, the Dark Overlord included a link for a 10-gigabyte archive of files they allegedly stole. That cache is encrypted, but the hackers are now threatening to release the relevant decryption keys, allowing the peons in the public to find out what's actually in there, and unlocking different sets of files, one at a time, unless the victims pay the hackers an undisclosed ransom fee in Bitcoin. And basically, they were threatened with, well, pay the you-know-what up or we're going to bury you with this. If you continue to fail us, said the demand, we'll escalate these releases by releasing the keys. Each time a layer is opened, a new wave of liability will fall upon you, says the demand letter. So there you have it, folks. It's kind of interesting. You do have to ask the question, is this a hacker that's actually threatening some really nasty people with revealing the truth about things that they've been hiding for years? Unless they pay up, kind of makes you wonder, who are the good guys in this situation, and will we ever hear the truth? We'll wrap it up today with just a brief reminder of exactly one such potential example. I don't know exactly what's going to be released or if anything will, but this is at least worth remembering. Here's a story from Derek Brose at the Activist Post, headlined, Never Forget. The government said the air was safe to the first responders and other people there at Ground Zero in New York City, but now thousands of 9/11 first responders have cancer or have already died. As Americans prepare, he says, for the 17th anniversary of that perhaps biggest false flag in American history, nearly 10,000 first responders and New York City residents have reported post-9/11 related cancers. In early August, the New York Post reported on newly released numbers of reported 9/11-related illnesses, including 9,795 total cases of 9/11-related cancers. The numbers were released by the federally funded, even, World Trade Center Health Sick program. And according to that program, there have already been more than 400 documented cases of death resulting from 9/11-related cancers. Unfortunately, though, the plight of men and women who rushed into Ground Zero on September the 11th, 2001, and over the following months, is often forgotten or maybe deliberately submerged in public conversation. But 17 years after the attacks, a number of first responders are still fighting for their lives. On Thursday, the LA Times reported 15 FBI agents that have died from cancers related to exposure to various toxins during their investigation and cleanup of the wreckage. And the Times noted that three of them have died since March, along with a 20-year veteran of the New Rochelle Police Department. The story goes on to describe case after case, but the bottom line is that each of these stories offer us a small glimpse into the everyday realities of these first responders who believed what they were told. Not to worry. Have we ever lied to you before? Famously, notes the piece, although maybe it's important to be reminded of this today, just 1 week after the 9/11 attacks, the Environmental Protection Agency's SIC Administrator Christine Todd Whitman released a statement declaring that the air and water surrounding Ground Zero were safe to breathe and drink. TruthStream Media reported on that situation, noting that back in May of 2007, 6 years after the event, a congressional investigation, SIC, was launched into the EPA's role in properly responding to the air quality emergency and environmental crisis in the immediate wake of those 9/11 attacks, and former EPA commissioner at that time, Christine Todd Whitman, refused then to testify, despite the fact that her statements on air quality right after the event had immediately affected hundreds of thousands of rescue workers and New York City residents, and more broadly, millions, until she was pressured under threat of subpoena, now that wouldn't matter anymore now, would it, by Congressman Gerald Nadler, whose district included Lower Manhattan, but, not to worry, she was officially cleared of any wrongdoing and defeated multiple lawsuits. there's a surprise. And just about a week from today, the corporate media and, as this guy puts it, conniving politicians will all put on their Never Forget pins and release their obligatory condolences to the family members and others affected by 9/11. No, I still don't think they're going to be apologizing to those of us who are suffering from the gang rape of the Bill of Rights, though, do you? There'll be TV specials and magazine editions and newspapers all commemorating the terror attack. And no, folks, they're still not going to tell you the truth. That at least hasn't changed. Thanks for joining us, and may Yahuwah bless you and yours.